Thank you, everybody, for your patience. We're just starting a few minutes late. We had some minor technical problems. I'd just like to welcome all of you to MHPN's interdisciplinary panel discussion. The title tonight is Collaborative Care in Mental Health and Substance Abuse Presentations. The panel tonight is a very talented one. We have Dr. Benny Monheit from Melbourne. We've got Associate Professor Lynn Mago-Blatch from Canberra and Professor Dan Ludman from Melbourne. I am Michael Murray from Townsville. The webinar is hosted by MHPN. This is a Commonwealth-funded project supporting the development of sustainable interdisciplinary collaboration in the local primary mental health sector across Australia. We currently support over 450 local interdisciplinary mental health networks. For further information, log on to mhpn.org.au. We have two learning objectives tonight. At the end of the session, participants will better understand the key principles of intervention and the roles of different disciplines in providing integrated primary mental health care services to mental health and substance abuse presentations. And secondly, to better understand the merits, challenges, and opportunities in providing collaborative care to people presenting with mental health and substance abuse issues. To find out more about your own disciplines, CPD recognition, please visit mhpn.org.au. The webinar is composed of two parts. Each one of our panel will present for approximately 5 minutes, and then we will have a facilitated interdisciplinary panel discussion. We'll have a question and answer format between the panelists, but we do very much welcome participants' questions and answers. We have had some questions already emailed into us, but please don't hesitate to put your questions in the message box on the right, and I will keep an eye out for suitable questions. There's some ground rules. I will moderate the panel discussion and field questions from you. As I said, you can submit questions. However, if your specific question is not addressed or if you want to continue the conversation, feel free to participate in a post-webinar online forum on MHPN online. It's important that if you need further technical support, to call 1-800-733-416. Please ensure that your sound is on and that your volume is turned up on your computer. If you're experiencing problems with sound, dial 1-800-142-516 and enter the passcode 40151365#. If you're having bandwidth issues, you can minimize this by pausing the presenter's webcam using the pause play tool under their video screen. You will still be able to hear the presenters when you pause their webcams. Webinar recording and PowerPoint slides will be posted on MHPN's website within 48 hours of the live activity. Please remember that for further technical support, call 1-800-733-416. We will now start with you, Benny. Benny Monheit, if you can give your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. I've been the GP looking after Susie for the last 10 years, and I must confess that it's been a fairly frustrating experience for most of that time, because Susie came basically for most appointments really just to get her script for methadone renewed. She didn't really want to talk very much. I mean, she was polite and pleasant, but she really didn't want to open up, like most patients do, about her background and her story. And I found that a bit unusual and a bit frustrating. And the other thing was that she would often drop off the methadone program. She would go up to the country and not pick up, and then she would have to come back and see me to renew the program. And so she was sort of like cycling in and out of treatment. And even when her sister died, as you probably read from the case history, I thought maybe this is a time when she would sort of open up a bit more, or be willing to accept a referral for support or consultation. No, she didn't really want to do that. until really about a year or 18 months ago, when she came in one day and suddenly wanted to be referred to a counsellor. And the presumed cause for this was that she was facing court hearing to in regard to access of her son, because her ex-partner was going to put forward that she was an unfit mother. That's so some of the issues, and it then became sort of an issue about who to refer her to, whether a psychiatrist or a psychologist, to find somebody who's suitable and to do it under a mental health care plan so that she wouldn't have to pay, and we sort of went on from there. She actually engaged with the psychologist very quickly and found it of great help. And even though I didn't get much feedback from the psychologist, I got a couple of very brief letters, but she gave a bit of feedback that she was she had stopped her drug use, cannabis and heroin, and was doing urine drug screens, and really, for the first time, felt happy. Now, there are a few other sort of issues, if we sort of that arise from that, that I think might be worthwhile discussing, and we'll see how we go with time. But one sort of issue, I think, is that most of us who work in this field know that for people with a substance abuse problem, there is often an underlying mental health issue. And the issue then for general practitioner or the prescriber is how much of this to take on themselves, because there's always a lot to do, both the sort of the general practice, medical care type of stuff. There is a substance abuse issue. There is the mental health issues, as well as the social problems that arise with Centrelink and housing and legal problems, and it just goes on. So there's a lot to do. And now some doctors do decide they want to do it all themselves, or there's no one there, or they feel it's a fairly simple problem, and that's fine. But when it becomes more complex, the issue is, what part am I going to ask for help here? What can I outsource? And what's my role as a doctor then, if other people are involved? Am I going to be the care coordinator or one of the team or the team leader? And they're sort of issues that sometimes go through my mind. And the more complex the patient, the more people are involved in this, the more difficult it can become, especially if you're sort of running short on time, as most doctors do. The other issue that sort of comes to mind is, what happens if we don't do everything under the sun for this patient? You know, people sometimes do get better, and there's actually quite a well-defined sort of natural maturing out, as it's called, or people just get better as they get older. So sometimes I remind myself, I don't have to rescue people all the time, or at all, really. So what is appropriate? How much intervention, really, should we put in there without, you know, too much or too little? The other point I just wanted to sort of make is really the central role of methadone and buprenorphine in a patient who's got heroin dependence. I think the evidence for that is very, very strong, and very occasionally, it's not often, but I have a counsellor or somebody who feels that not very comfortable about that and recommends the patient sort of should come off the methadone or buprenorphine, and I get very angry and unhappy about somebody else telling my patient what to do about their methadone or buprenorphine. So that raises some other sort of issues very, very quickly about collaborative care, and I don't know how far we'll get into this in this discussion, but you know, obviously it depends on what's available in your area, your own expertise and interests, and what sort of model you want to use. We know that mental health issues are very common in general practice, and GPs are increasingly sort of using referral to psychologists and psychiatrists. And sometimes the psychologist and psychiatrist are actually in the same clinic or visit there, and so you have a one-stop shop, and I think that really lends itself to direct face-to-face discussions, and I find that really I get the most out of, because I know what the psychologist or psychiatrist is thinking and working towards, and we can ask each other questions. Sometimes there is sort of a different model that look after the simple ones, but if it's more complex, we refer it out to the local drug and alcohol agency or the local mental health clinic, sort of like a stepped care approach that you go up the steps as the complexity rises. And finally, the point I just make is communication between team members is one of the key issues. And I think I do like to get feedback from the psychologists and psychiatrists. I think psychiatrists have been much better at this because it's part of the medical model. But I think psychologists, even though they might complain they don't have time and they don't get paid for it, I think it is an essential part of the team work. And even I don't mind even getting emails. I'm not into Twitters, but it doesn't have to be a long essay. But I want to know what you're doing, whether they've turned up, and whether the patient's improving. So there's some of the points.
Thank you very much, Benny. That's a very good introduction to our topic tonight. Next, we'll hear from Lynn. Lynn, if you can just start your presentation now. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And thanks, Benny, for that perspective on Susie. I think, as everyone has realised from the information that we have, Susie's quite a complex presentation. However, from I guess from an AOD perspective, those of us who work in alcohol and other drugs, what we recognise is that comorbidity and co-occurring disorders are the expectation rather than the exception. So in that sense, I mean, Susie's case is actually the sort of case that we would see quite a lot. I think there are a few things that I would like to raise, and obviously, we don't have all of the information in front of us, and it's possible that Benny, as the GP or as any GP in this particular case, may also not have all of the information either. So there are a whole lot of things that come to mind around family and relationships. We know about the family of origin, for instance, that the family are post-war immigrants from Italy. I think what's important in this is often the migration story, and often what will happen, and we see it very often in drug and alcohol, is that we have a situation where people who are born in this country but of parents who come from another country kind of get caught, they kind of get sandwiched between cultural expectations, so expectations and beliefs of the system of the parents, and also trying to get into a new country and adopt a new way of life in Australia. That's one thing that comes up. One of the other things that really is important in this is that we know that there are two children in this family, Susie and her older sister. Both of them are both heroin users, and Susie's sister has died of a drug overdose when Susie was 27 years old. So there's a whole lot of things, I think, to explore around their relationship and also their drug using history, both together and also apart. One of the points that Benny has made too, which I think is an important one, is this whole issue about a whole of life model. And the whole of life model is something that we see very much in the criminology literature, but we haven't seen so much in the drug and alcohol literature. And basically it's around the fact that people to some extent mature out of their drug using behaviour, and that's somewhat reassuring, of course. But it also means that what we're looking for is that we're looking for a way of keeping people safe and supporting them during that period of time. So, looking back at relationships in Susie's life is a really important one. I would also really be looking to see how we might engage the family as well. We know from the information we've got that the family has been reluctant to engage, and in fact Susie herself has been reluctant to engage in any counselling. So the interesting thing that's happened in this case is that an external motivator, and we often see that. So looking at people's stages of change, trying to assess where they're up to in that cycle of change, stage of change, and therefore organising an intervention that suits that is, I guess, one of the challenges for people working in this situation. From a psychologist's perspective, and those of you who are tuned in tonight and who are psychologists might have some perspective on this, I think one of the things that is unfortunate is that we don't have a lot of training very often for psychologists in working in drug and alcohol. And in fact, the whole area of working in a collaborative approach, I think, is extremely important. I've worked for a number of years in a doctor's surgery, and one of the things that happened in that kind of environment was it meant that the GP was able to, the GPs in that practice were able to communicate quite openly, and we talked, we all learnt something from each other. And it meant that, in fact, for the client, there was also the possibility of being able to have a kind of a seamless transition. So they weren't seeming to be sent on to somebody else. In fact, what was happening was that they were still coming into the surgery, they were just seeing another practitioner within the surgery. And so that was, an important aspect of their treatment. I think that's, something to look at. In terms of the treatment process, I would be hoping that we might work with Susie to look at some of her underlying issues. There's trauma, there's grief and loss in the family history, and particularly, again, thinking about how the family can be brought into the treatment process. One of the issues, I guess, that I would also want to explore is the possibility of different treatment options. So Susie has been prescribed methadone and then Suboxone as the only treatment intervention. I certainly take on the fact that she has also refused to have to go through to counselling it until this last point. But was there a possibility also of other treatment interventions, such as, for instance, therapeutic community or other external counselling situations that may not have included pharmacotherapies at that point in time? At the same time, as I said before, it seems quite clear that Jack, her son, has proven to be an incredible motivator for Susie to seek treatment at this time. And so she's finally come to see a psychologist, and it may be that given her reluctance before and the fact that she was probably in the pre-contemplation or only slightly into the contemplation stage in terms of stages of change, that she may not have been prepared at that point in time for that sort of help, which she has now. One last thing I think about Susie, because I'm probably running out of time, I should think, is that I think there are some tremendous strengths. Whatever the odds are against Susie in terms of what's happened in her life, she has managed to complete her bookkeeping course, even though she had a difficult time at school. She has completed her bookkeeping course. She has therefore managed to have the skills that enabled her to resume employment. She does have family support, and she also has a powerful motivator in her son, Jack. So I think building on the strength that Susie provides would be one of the ways that I would like to work with her. So I think that's all I'd like to say at this point in time. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you very much, Lynn. That was a lovely presentation. Thank you very much. Now we'll just move on to Dan.
Thanks, Michael. And thanks for putting this case together. I think what this case really illustrates is really what certainly my practice is seeing more and more is that GPs are engaging psychologists with better outcomes in mental health, and then I'm getting referrals at some point later to sort of have additional sort of input into the process. And I think working together as a team of GP psychologists and psychiatrists is a really powerful way of, you know, really covering all the bases in terms of managing patients with a whole range of different issues. So when I get referred a patient like this, I suppose what I'm thinking about is often I'm trying to understand from the patient's perspective why they're really here and what they actually want to get out of this. Often patients come without either without being fully briefed, so they just get sent to me with sort of just said, oh, it's important to go and see a psychiatrist, but without really understanding what the role of the psychiatrist is or what they're expecting from me. So I really like to sort of get to understand why they're here and what they want to get out, particularly at this assessment. And I really want to be clear from their own perspective around what their short-term and long-term goals actually are. And in this case, it really relates to issues of a custody of a child, her health issues, her drug use, what she really wants to do about treatment, and what sort of what are her goals around the types of support that she needs to sort of move forward. In terms of sort of really clarifying the history, so often I'll be, particularly under the new sort of mental health schemes, I'll often be referred these patients by GPs under a 291 item, so it's a sort of a one-off assessment to feed back to both the psychologist and the GP. So I think that my role in this setting is often to take quite a comprehensive history and to sort of try and work out sort of how the different pieces of the jigsaw fit together and to provide sort of feedback and advice around where parts of the treatment plan should be focused, particularly in the short term. And certainly in the case of Susie, I'd be really interested in sort of taking a much fuller developmental history, particularly understanding her relationship with her parents during childhood, her school and work experiences, where there's, you know, it seems from the case that she was quite isolated. So I'd really want to explore issues of bullying or exclusion, what sort of support she has in life and what actual achievements she's made and how she views those achievements or doesn't. I'd be really interested, you know, given sort of the reaction she had to her partner and some of her comments around her father, really understanding what her experiences with males were, be it her father, partner's ex-partner, and given sort of we don't know much about how she's been funding her habit for so long, I certainly want to explore sort of whether there's issues about abusive relationships with men in that context. And then I'd really want to understand her relationship with her son and her parenting experiences and how important that relationship has been in many different ways in her life. I'd want to understand the issue of mental illness and substance use within her family, and I'd really want to explore the relationship with her sister in terms of her level of connection growing up, you know, whether that continued into adulthood, how, you know, they're both into using drugs, to what degree do they use drugs together, to what degree does she feel responsible or not responsible for her sister's death, and really exploring whether there's sort of unresolved grief issues there that really haven't been addressed previously. The other issue that I think that's really important is obviously the consistent factor in her life has been her parents, although reading sort of the referral letter and it seems to me that it seems quite an ambivalent relationship with the parents with lots of potential unresolved issues, and with her a child coming into her life with her parents offering support, really want to explore what type of support that was, be it emotional, financial and practical, and what does it mean when there might be unresolved family issues and Susie's reliant on her parents for financial support. I really want to explore that. Excuse me. In terms of substance use, I'd really, you know, want to go into depth about understanding her current past drug use, her previous treatment history and her response, and really try and pick out sort of her motivations for use. You know, why is it, what is using about, what was using about in the past, what is it about at the moment, and really get her perspectives on that. And I'd really want to explore in terms of her drug use, and yes, we've heard that she wants to change because of her child, but really trying to understand her readiness and confidence to change. So I often have clients, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how ready are you in terms of wanting to change your drug use at the moment? You know, is that anywhere from 1 being not at all to 10 being very ready? And then I'd ask them, if people say, you know, 5 out of 10 in terms of readiness, I'd ask questions about, well, what would need to change or what things would need to happen to move that from a 5 to a 7. Similarly, you know, people can want to and feel ready to change, but they don't feel confident. And particularly for people who have poor self-esteem or have a history of failure in their life, confidence issues can be a key problem. So I'd be asking Susie, you know, even though you feel ready and want to do something about your substance use, to what degree do you feel confident in that on a scale of 1 to 10? And again, if she sort of said that she rated herself around 5 or 7, I'd want to know, well, what would need to happen to get you to an 8 or a 9 out of 10? I'd want to explore her current change plan, and I'd want to try and identify with her what are the current barriers to either stopping or ceasing use, both in the past and currently. Issues of a Hep C and sort of where that originated, particularly in terms of how that relates to her injecting style or other behaviours, risky behaviours she's been involved in, how she deals with that, how she's disclosed that, what support she gets from that, and how that's impacting on her view of herself. And then in terms of a mental health assessment, I really want to understand, is there an underlying depression, anxiety, PTSD, unresolved trauma or grief? I'd want to explore to see whether there's any other cluster B sort of personality traits. I want to really identify coping strategies, and I see sort of in the messages people are already identifying this, but certainly for me, you know, one of the main drivers of people that we see, you know, have ongoing problems with substance use is often, you know, using substances to cope with difficult affects or difficult stressful situations or dealing with conflict. And certainly want to explore that and explore what are the coping styles, what are coping strategies Susie has in terms of dealing with those difficult conflictual situations. And if she was to stop and there wasn't any substance use available, how is she going to cope and deal with that? I'd really want to understand her understanding of the relationship between her drug use and her, any sort of mental health issues that she has, whether she thinks there's a connection or not. And I'd obviously want to conduct a detailed mental state examination. And then in terms of initial management, I suppose that will depend on the outcome of the assessment, but I think it's really important in terms of my role to provide a really simple formulation of the findings back to Susie in terms of how her life history is impacting on her current situation. I'd certainly want to provide some psychoeducation, and certainly for this client group, my main focus would be a psychological approach and to identify areas to work with on an ongoing way with the psychologist and potentially with myself if necessary. One of the important things, and we can discuss this more in more detail, I think, during the conference, but I'm particularly reluctant to prescribe pharmacotherapy. Many of the patients that I see with a long history of drug use are often very skilled in using pharmaceutical drugs and much more powerful drugs than I can provide for dealing with difficult affects or difficult situations, and often are seeking a pharmacological solution to their problems. And so we can talk a bit about sort of when to prescribe this population, but certainly, you know, I certainly promote a psychological approach first, unless there's really significant disorder issues or significant risk issues. And then it's about feeding back to the GP and the psychologist and thinking about what my ongoing role might or might not be. And I'll finish there, Michael.
Thanks very much, Dan. And thank you, Lynn and Benny as well. We're now going to move on to the segment of the webinar where panelists will ask each other questions, and I will also interrupt with some questions from the audience. Benny, I believe you have a question for Dan.
All right. Okay, Dan. let me just find it. Here we are. When do you think we should refer these patients to a psychiatrist, rather, let's say, than a psychologist, the role of antidepressants. Many of our patients go through phases of whether you call it dysphoria or depression, which doesn't quite sort of meet all the clinical criteria for clinical depression, but they really get very sad and sometimes even worry about suicidal ideation. What are some of the issues you think about whether to start somebody on antidepressants when they've got coexisting polydrug use and particular heroin use and a bit erratic in their behaviour, in their medication taking?
Yeah, thanks, mate. I mean, I'll take your last question first. Look, I think it's incredibly complex. I mean, particularly in a patient like Susie, there's a whole range of different issues that might be impacting on her mood. We know that, you know, for people who have a chaotic pattern of using, we know that many of the drugs that people are taking are depressogenic and can cause a substance-induced syndrome. In fact, we just recently published a large study in the MJA looking at patients who were regularly using methamphetamine and basically identified that around 40% might met criteria for a major depression, but another 44% met criteria for a substance-induced depression. So about 84% of the sample met criteria for a depression of some description. And when you look at the symptom counts, it's really difficult to actually differentiate between the two. So the bottom line is that depressive symptoms are really common in this population group, and I think it is really difficult to actually unpack what's going on. And for me, the question is this a clear-cut major depression? Is this a substance-induced depression? Is this actually an underlying dysthymia, as you were saying, or is this an underlying mood instability related to an underlying cluster B or other type of personality traits? Or, you know, to some degree, you know, is this around sort of an immature affect regulation system? I mean, we know that many of the clients we see who start using substances at an early age, often to cope with difficult life situations, you start to use drugs when the rest of us are learning how to manage really difficult mood swings and learn to take control of those. And often when we see them in the late 20s or early 30s and we take drugs away, then they haven't actually learned to sort of manage those really massive sort of swings in emotion. And certainly I talk to my patients a lot about, you know, they might be 30 years of age sort of physically, but emotionally, in terms of managing their emotional state, you know, they might only have an emotional age of around 14, given that's when they started to use drugs to block out their emotions and deal with their emotions. So I think my bottom line is it's really complex. I tend, you know, to wait as long as possible before I introduce pharmacotherapy. If you look at most of the literature on pharmacotherapy for major depression in patients like this, most of the pharmaceutical trials exclude patients with drug and alcohol dependence, so we don't really have good data. When we look at the ones that do treat people with alcohol and drug disorders, they form into two groups. One group, if we look at people who are treated for alcohol, for example, and comorbid depression, there's no difference between an antidepressant and placebo for those group who are starting on antidepressants while they're still drinking. But if we wait and we detox and we see whether they're still depressed once they've stopped drinking, and then we introduce an antidepressant if they're still depressed, the evidence there shows that antidepressants are quite effective. So the bottom line is that drug use is depressogenic and it can cause lots of problems. And really, I think we need to be skeptical about and cautious around medication. And I think it's working with the patient on a psychological approach first, I think, is something I would push.
Thanks very much, Dan. They're very, very good points. I believe just moving off the pharmacotherapy now, just onto the non-pharmacological therapies, I believe you have a question for Lynn. Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I have quite a few questions for Lynn, but the ones I'll ask is really about, you know, and I think a lot of people I've seen people already asking these questions in the messages section. I mean, you know, often, you know, we're referring patients to psychologists and the Better Outcomes in Mental Health initiative, which is now down to 10 funded sessions, except I noticed there's 6 sessions now for exceptional circumstances. And I suppose my question is, from your perspective, when you get somebody who's really complex, who hasn't engaged, has a lot of issues, you know, what do you decide to focus on when you've only got 10 sessions? Particularly, you know, if they haven't engaged with other people and, you know, there might be trust issues there in terms of thwarting any sort of therapeutic relationship.
Look, I guess the underlying, you know, the main answer to that question is that you don't get to decide, that in lots of ways the client decides. So, you know, kind of working out what is the presenting issue and what is the most important thing is something that you have to be guided by the client. I mean, taking the information, taking the history, getting the client's perspective on what's happening in the life is going to guide that process. I think, you know, it's always difficult. The reality is that's not enough sessions for a complex, you know, client such as Susie would be. And in drug and alcohol, that's pretty much, this is, you know, pretty much the sort of client who we see presenting. So it's difficult. That's the underlying, you know, that's the first thing, is it's difficult. But I would be guided by what the client is feeling like they want to work with. And I guess, you know, different people work in different ways. So, for instance, you know, we talk about CBT as being the kind of the gold star in lots of ways. It's because it's been the most researched. However, you know, I particularly would work, I see acceptance commitment therapy and mindfulness-based processes really, really important and really effective with this particular client group. In working with trauma, you might use EMDR. So it really depends on I guess the psychologist's own kind of strengths. But certainly, as I said, certainly there's a lot of research showing now that acceptance commitment therapy is a really, really useful way of working. I work with my clients in that way, and one of the things that they feedback all the time is that they see it as being meeting them where they are, and they understand it because they don't have to kind of try and work out what's a negative thinking pattern and so on, because very often these kind of processes and the things that have that have been in their lives are the things that are getting them through. So they may seem like, to us from the outside, they may seem like there's a lot of dysfunction, but in fact you have to see that there's a lot of functionality that in fact people are getting through. I mean, we're seeing artwork that's flashing up on the screen at the moment too. I use sand play therapy, for instance. So using art therapy, schema-based therapy, and particularly though coming from the point where of a strengths-based perspective, I think is really important. In working with any of our clients. I probably haven't answered your question, Dan, about how do you decide. But I think the underlying thing is that you need to be guided by the client themselves. And I think one of the other things that we've made a mistake about very often in drug and alcohol work is that we have this kind of idea that we're going to, you know, break down barriers. I mean, I think the really important thing to understand is that our clients have got those kind of fences and barriers up because they're their support, they're their safety mechanism. And so things start to kind of come down at the time when, when they're ready to actually start to work on something. And for that reason, then you see sort of breakthroughs come at different times. Susie needs a lot more than 10 sessions. And that's a message that really needs to be given, you know, to people who make those decisions around the number of sessions.
Thanks very much, Lynn. I don't think any participant or panelist here would disagree with you on the 10 sessions. I think that's a given that they're inadequate. Would you just in relation to collaboration, just in some of our talks before we started, Lynn, I believe you have a question that you'd like to address to Benny in relation to collaboration between us all.
Well, thanks for that. Benny, you did actually mention before about working with psychologists, psychiatrists and so on within the general practice setting, or you talked about it as a one-stop shop. And I think, you know, I think one of the things that comes out in this particular case is that, you know, we're all very aware that GPs would have limited time and limited resources in terms of what they can do with a client who just comes in, or a patient who just comes in for that short period of time. So I guess what I'd really like to know is, or to talk about, I guess, is how you decide on the best course of treatment or an advice on that treatment, particularly given the fact, and Dan's mentioned it as well, that moving straight into pharmacotherapies or straight into a medical intervention may or may not be the best solution in some situations. and really what opportunities you would see in working collaboratively with other health professionals. And I don't only include psychologists and psychiatrists, but I also include OTs, social workers and others who really have a role to play in a case such as this.
Well, thanks, Lynn. That's hard to know where to start. But, I mean, the reality is that patients come to the doctor often already with their mind set on a certain treatment. So for me, I often get people referred in or self-referred wanting to go on methadone or buprenorphine. And even though I talk through the options before I would start that, it usually ends up giving the patient what they want. Often they've either been on a program before or they've had friends come in. I mean, if they wanted to, just for argument's sake, go on naltrexone implant, well, they wouldn't come to me because that's not what I do. But I do get patients who come in and say, look, I don't know where to start. I've heard you've got an interest and expertise in drug and alcohol. What do you recommend? And then I think, you know, well, I really sit down with them and we go through the options and they've got to make a decision. And what they sometimes don't know, because certainly in Melbourne and most cities, it's a bit of a maze, really, about what services are available. And you don't know where to start. So the doctor is often the first port of call, and we go through the options. You know, if it's heroin use, it might be detox, it might be therapy, or it might be opiate replacement therapy. It's usually not that difficult. Occasionally they want to go, or I encourage them to have a think about it, particularly young people. I worry about putting young people on methadone or buprenorphine or referring them into a really sort of very long-term rehab programs, because it might just be a phase that they're going through. But I put the options to them, and they got to make the decision. And then we go with that, and I try to sort of then get on with things pretty quickly, because it's a window of opportunity. You don't want them sitting around and waiting too long to start. You lose them, and it's really dangerous for their health if they're using drugs, and because all sorts of things can happen. So once they've made up their mind, I think one's got to move quickly, and that includes, let's say, referring to other health workers. It's no good having a waiting list of 3 months or 6 months. It's an absolute waste. So if you want to get them into detox, or you want them to see a psychologist or a mental health nurse, well, you've got to have some system of getting in there quickly, even if it means ringing the person up and say, look, I know you booked out, but I've got this patient X, Y, Z who I think really needs to see you quickly. And we do that for other specialties. You know, when somebody has a heart attack, we don't sort of wait around. We ring our colleague and say, Jim, you've got to see this lady tonight because she's had unstable angina. So it's knowing the people who you can ring helps. And sometimes in country areas, you have a better idea of who is in the network than we do in the city. But we often rely on friends, colleagues, to push the boundaries or to get easy access if we really want to. So it's a bit complex too out there, but we, in this situation, we work as an advocate for the patient, and it sort of makes it difficult if the patient doesn't want that, or is unpleasant, or has got a previous, bad experience in the clinic. You don't like all your patients, but you try and help as much as you can. And some, of course, it's easier than others. But it helps, I find, to have a network of people that you work with regularly and can contact either for advice or for referral or to expedite things.
Thanks very much. That was very interesting. One of the questions that I've noticed coming from more than one participant is the aspect of over-assessment and the question of when does collaboration start? And I'd like to address this to the three of you, so you can all jump in as you wish, but we all tend to work within our own little area, pharmacological, non-pharmacological, psychiatry. When does collaboration start? Is it an individual thing, or should we have a collaborative model?
I'd like to make a comment on that. I personally think we should have a collaborative model. But I think, you know, one of the things that's probably coming out tonight, and I'm watching some of the comments coming through too, is that, you know, people are probably seeing a bit of overlap between the psychiatrist and the psychologist in this situation. I have to say Dan's a bit of a special psychiatrist, as people are also mentioning, in that, and this was actually a question that I had actually raised for Dan anyway, was around the fact that often psychiatrists are really just seen as being the people who are prescribing medication rather than actually doing therapy and working with a client. And so there is I guess, a possibility that the person gets over-serviced if, in fact, we're all doing the same thing. And that's a really important issue in terms of how you communicate. And also that the client needs to be part of that communication system. I mean, I think that there's a real danger in all of the professionals talking about someone. It's like talking about the child who's not in the room or actually is in the room. And it's really important for the client to be involved in that. So my comment is that I think collaboration is really important. And especially where there is, you know, the possibility of a whole lot of overlap. And by that, I'm not suggesting that we should all therefore, you know, go back to our silos, because the silo approach is no use either to the client.
Benny, can I ask you to comment on that? Because you mentioned in your presentation, when do you decide to collaborate, when do you decide to refer on? I'd be interested in your comments.
I do it if the patient asks for it and if I want some help, basically, I think. Some patients are very good at saying, you know, I want to see so-and-so, and that's easy. The more difficult ones is when I sort of have some doubts or some questions. Like with Susie, you know, when she wasn't making any progress, I was thinking, you know, am I missing something here? Has she got some post-traumatic stress disorder that I should be diagnosing, and you know, she's sort of stuck. I sort of sometimes refer people when I want some help in either diagnosis or treatment. The issue of collaboration, yeah, it's I agree with the point about over-assessment, and it's an issue that sort of might become more relevant when people start having known patient health histories, because people said, well, you know, we don't all need to reassess them. You know, they should just have one assessment and everyone should be able to access that if they're treating them. And I don't know whether that actually really works, because I think each of us look at the patient from a different perspective, both, you know, psychiatrist, psychologist, mental health nurse. We could certainly agree about the basic history about drug use and milestones, but if we all did assessments on Susie, I think we would probably all come with slightly different perspectives and priorities based on our experience and so I don't know whether a commonly held record or a unified assessment and then triage is really the best way to go. It's sort of beloved by governments, I think, who sort of see this as an answer. But I don't know whether that works in practice. I don't know whether anyone's got any experience in this. So collaboration is, you know, it's sort of, it just, when you work in the front line, it just sort of happens as and when you actually think of what is the process, it's sort of almost a bit of a foreign concept, because you do it all the time without thinking too hard. You know, you try and work out who can I get to help this patient, where can I send them to, and It's only when you're sort of challenged, you know, well, what's going through your mind? How do you decide? It's actually, you have to start to think about it a bit more.
That's a very good answer. Thank you. Dan, how do you feel about collaboration? And I mean,
I think we have to be honest that we all work in an incredibly fragmented system where, you know, there's disincentives for us to actually talk to each other. And, you know, if we want to work in a collaborative way, that actually takes effort. And it often takes effort in a way, you know, if we're working in private practice where we're not actually reimbursed, or you know, our time's not actually reimbursed to actually make the effort to do that.
Yep.
But I think for anybody, you know, who's had experience of working well in a collaborative relationship, I think, you know, there's no doubt that the patient really benefits from that approach. And it certainly, when you're working in a team approach, there's no doubt everybody really understands their role and feels really contained and feels like they're all on message and on point and knows what their specific task and role actually is. So collaboration is the goal. And I think the reality is to do that means that we actually have to invest time in identifying. So for me, you know, I'm fortunate that I work in a practice where I've got a number of psychologists in the same clinic. So, you know, we can have corridor conversations around patients and talk to each other about patients, and you know, it leads to much better management of those patients. And certainly over time, because I've been in the same practice for a while, people I see with drug problems often, you know, again, only see specific GPs who are happy to see those patients. Again, over time, I've developed, you know, relationships with those GPs so that we can, you know, they're happy for me to call them, and they're happy for me to call them often on their private mobile, you know, because we've had a long-standing relationship. And that's what works. That, you know, like in anything in life, that personal connection and relationship. So the perspective I just want to bring on it is that the system actually dissuades us from working in the collaborative way and puts up lots of barriers. There's lots of benefits to doing it, but it takes a lot of work.
Thanks very much, Dan. Benny, I believe that you had a question for Lynn in relation to poor compliance and how to deal with poor compliance with patients, clients on methadone program. Would you like to expand on that question for Lynn, for me, please?
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. You know, with Susie, she wasn't doing what I wanted her to do. Now, am I just being stubborn here and not getting my way? Or, you know, are patients not... Why don't patients do what we tell them to? And they obviously got their own sort of issues, but what I would have liked Susie to do is stay on the program, see a counsellor, get her life on track, and then sort of stop using and eventually come off the methadone and be happy for the rest of her life. Now, she didn't quite sort of fit in with that sort of plan. She had her own timelines. We might have got there in the end, but I mean, compliance, I think, is a real issue, both in terms of medications as well as keeping appointments, as well as just making progress. And I was wondering, have you got any sort of hints about what we could do better to improve outcomes?
Again, it's a million-dollar question, isn't it? I think, you know, sometimes compliance, sometimes it's the only power the client feels they have, of course, is to be non-compliant because choosing to go on or off the medication, to keep appointments or not keep appointments and so on, is all around the sorts of things that are happening for Susie at the time. I mean, you know, we have the benefit of looking at this case over time and seeing that in the end, you know, because of a number of situations, such as the relationships, the death of her sister, although, you know, as you say, that actually created more problems for her in the sense that her drug use actually escalated during that time rather than diminished. And that, you know, it's one of those things that happens. It seems sort of, not expected, but obviously is expected in the sense it's because it's the person's reaction to grief and loss, and maybe guilt. So, you know, in the end, yes, she got there. I guess one of the things about, and again, this is, you know, the kind of the benefits of being in a practice where there's a number of people who you can kind of bounce things off and talk about things and so on, is that being in a practice like that might have given the option for Susie to have actually seen a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or, you know, another mental health professional or someone who could have worked with her, but actually getting a referral out to somebody else was probably not what she was going to do. I mean, the really important thing in this, from your perspective and from GP's perspective, is the GP is often the first point of call for people. And that's a really positive issue because of the fact that the GP maintains a kind of a lifeline very often. And maintaining that is, you know, shouldn't be underestimated in any sort of way. But it may be that when you look at the kind of the situation, the things that happen in Susie's life or in anyone's life, that there are kind of trajectory points where there's a possibility of an intervention that got missed along the way and may have just been missed because of the circumstances, because of the fact that not all of the people were there and able to intervene. On a positive note, yes, she did remain, she was non-compliant at times, but she remained alive and she has now, she's now come back into treatment. I certainly raised the point that perhaps and I think, you said about the client coming in and wanting to be on methadone or wanting to be on a pharmacotherapy and you're feeling that you need to respond to that. And I'm in no way, saying that's not right, because I think one of the things that too often happens is that we have the extreme recovery people at one end who say, never, never, never should anyone be on a pharmacotherapy, and we have the extreme pharmacotherapy group at the other end who say that, people need to stay on it for life and they can never come off it because it's like a kind of an insulin for a kind of diabetes, a drug addiction of diabetes. And I don't think either of those extremes are particularly helpful. I think, we need to have somewhere in the middle that actually means that the person has some choices. And actually being able to understand what those variety of choices are is therefore important, so that, having information available, being able to have a whole variety of places that you can refer to, and again, people within the one medical practice or the one practice is really important in being able to provide those kind of possibilities. And may actually give the possibility of being referred earlier or in a different way, if that was a possibility.
Yes, thanks very much, Lynn. May I just ask you, Dan? What do you see the role of the mental health nurse in the management of these clients?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think as part of a collaborative care plan, I think there's a whole range of different roles that we all can have, and obviously needs to be tailored to the patient need. I mean, the problem I think with GPs, psychiatrists and psychologists is often we're clinic bound. So we all sit in, often I'll see somebody who sees a GP, sees a psychologist and sees me, but they always have to come and see us. And often there's some patients who have really poor self-esteem, who have poor self-efficacy, and really, certainly the mental health nurses I work with, they're able actually to go out and see the client in their house and actually engage with them and spend time with them and actually go with them to a whole range of activities and events, so taking them to the gym or taking them to a range of different appointments. So where I see the role of, particularly where I use a mental health nurse a lot, is in terms of engaging people who don't really have very few other supports and find it very difficult to engage with a whole range of different sort of roles and activities that they need to engage in to actually progress. And certainly using mental health nurses in that way has been absolutely fantastic. But, you know, I think, again, it's all about, you know, tailoring what the relevant professional group is or how many people the person needs to see or not to the client's case. And I think that's often difficult because there is often a temptation to get over-involved. So we get referred lots of patients. And I you know, for me, you know, somebody seeing the GP and the psychologist and I see them and I do assessments and I feel, geez, they've got lots of issues, there's things I can work on with them. The temptation, I think, particularly for many of these patients who have, you know, are often very needy, you know, have a lot of dependency needs, have a lot of unmet needs, is to get over-involved and for us all to sort of get involved with the patient who then often feels overwhelmed and then withdraws from all of us. So I think there is a challenge there in terms of working out what does that person need at that time and how much dose to give the person. And that's where talking to each other and working out what is the role, how frequent should we be working together and seeing the client is critically important.
Benny, may I just ask you, what role do you see for other practitioners apart from psychiatrists and psychologists in the management of patients?
I don't have the luxury of having a mental health nurse or sort of a social worker. I work at two clinics, and one of them we do have a multidisciplinary team, and I find that's actually a great way when it's all in one house, and we meet once a week, and we discuss patients, and I think that's, to me, the best way of collaborating. It's a luxury, but if you can do it, it works really well. Now, I don't have an answer really about, because I haven't had a mentor about other people, but as we know, it's really not so much profession they come from, it's their person's attitude and their ability to sort of work with this group of patients, that's the key issue. And we know from lots of studies that it's actually, we've got to try and keep the patient engaged and whatever it takes. And, you know, there are some workers that are really great at going out to people and meeting them in the street and talking and supporting them, whether it's a needle exchange centre or it's out in the lanes of capital cities. I take my hat off to them. I couldn't do that. So I think it's a person's own sort of personality that's the key issue. And if we can keep them engaged, then we know that from studies that the prognosis improves.
Dan, I think you had a comment that you wanted to make about something that...
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, I think sometimes, particularly when we assess and see people who are particularly complex and we can see all the issues that they have, that we can get sucked into the idea of that this person needs a lot of treatment over a lot of time and we need to be really engaged with them and we need to sort of keep them in treatment for a long time. So I just wanted to make a comment about that because my experience, and I've been fortunate enough to be involved in a number of clinical trials where we've offered people with comorbid mental health and substance use treatment a range of psychological treatments from brief interventions through to 10 weeks of CBT through to 20 weeks of case management and CBT. And I suppose what's been really surprising for me is that what we found is often, you know, quite a significant proportion, you know, sizable portion drop out after 4 weeks. And you would suppose that those who drop after 4 weeks won't be doing as well as those who actually end up doing 12 weeks or 20 weeks. But what we find from the data is actually many of the people who drop out after 4 weeks are doing just as well as those who stay in for longer. That really has changed my view on what it is that people are seeking from treatment. And I agree with Benny that, you know, if we're looking at a life course, if we're looking at for somebody who has a range of issues, then certainly they're likely to need a range of treatment over a sustained period of time. But I think one of the challenges for us in treatment is when somebody comes to see us one point, we're really, despite whatever the patient might tell us, we're really not really clear what the drivers might be to why they're there, really there at the moment. You know, is it because they really want to be there, or is it because there's a family member or a court order or a variety of other things that are really driving that agenda? And for me, the issue is, you know, I always assume that I'm only going to see somebody for a maximum of 4 sessions because, you know, they're likely to drop out. And so if I have that framework, I'm thinking about, you know, what is it that I can get across? What good experience of treatment and what key coping skills and what key messages and what key approaches can I get across to that individual in those 4 sessions, because I might not have the luxury of seeing them for an extended period, despite what they might say to me in terms of, you know, really wanting to engage in the process. That was the point I was just trying to make, is I think often, you know, we need to understand that we will only see a client, you know, I think De Clemente says this really well, you know, that often when we see a client and we assess them, you know, often the client is a stream in a river, you know, a big stream, and we take a step into the stream or the river and we make an assessment at that point, but, you know, we come back a week later or a month later and the river's moved on. And so I think we need to be aware that things change all the time, and that, yes, it's important that, you know, clients engage with the system over time, but they might only need a small amount of things from us at any one time, a small amount of talking about issues or some small coping skills or just a good experience of treatment. They might have had, you know, really bad experiences in terms of opening up and trusting others. And so it's really important to think about at any one time point how much we can give somebody and what the focus should be at that time.
Thanks very much, Dan. Lynn, we're just running out of time, unfortunately, and this may be the very last question, but it does come from a participant. Lynn, what role do you see families and significant others having in involvement in care and therapy?
Look, I think that's a really important one. I used to describe it a bit like, you know, you'd have this turmoil sometimes, but things kind of happening that's the family, and you pluck one person out of it and you treat them, and meantime over here the family's still going, and then, you know, you're working with this person and then you're going to fit them back in, and it's not going to work because the family has gone on. The family, you know, one way of looking at it is the family is both the architect and the victim of what happens within the family. I have this whole series of Russian dolls. They're my favourite thing, and I use them all the time to illustrate what kind of happens within a family system, that it really is important. And that's why I did actually mention in looking at it from the psychologist's perspective, that you really do want to, if possible, engage the family and certainly the significant others in working with the family, with the family dynamic. At the same time, recognising that maybe the family is also the cause of some of the problems, again, you know, one of the things you'd be wanting to do, hopefully, is work with the client so that they're empowered to make those decisions themselves. Because one of the really difficult things that often happens in drug and alcohol work is that a client comes to a point where they actually decide that they want to move on from the family, that they can't get back into the family system, or that the family system is such that is actually causing them, causing a lot of the problems. And that's sometimes really the heartbreaking thing about it. I mean, you know, the research shows that the family can be an incredibly supportive system, but also may be some of the cause of the problem as well. So engaging the family is important, but also recognising the fact that the person may want to move on from the family.
Thanks very much, Lynn. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I've really enjoyed the past hour and a quarter I've spent with you all. I feel very privileged to have spent this time with three such talented panelists. And also, from the comments I see coming through from 250 very talented participants as well, and I certainly have learned a lot, and it will help me a lot in my general practice. I would ask everybody, all the participants, to please complete the exit survey before you log out. You can continue the interdisciplinary discussion online, on MHPN online. Each participant will be sent a link to online resources associated with this webinar, within 48 hours. And the next MHPN webinar is Perinatal Mental Health, Working Together, Working Better. And that will be on the 19th of March, 2012. Further information is available from the website. And for those of you who were asking about the art that was published, I'm going to leave this slide up here so you can access those artists down the track. As I said, I feel very privileged to have been involved in this webinar. We discussed collaboration, our different roles, the busyness that we all experience, the strengths that we should look for in our clients, the importance, as Lynn mentioned, of the family of origin, and as Dan mentioned, the developmental history and relationships, and Benny alluded to this as well, that there were often unresolved issues and things that never came up within the consultation or the interview. That we should always look for motivation for change and to explore the barriers for a cessation of substances. Once again, thank you everybody for partaking in this, particularly our panelists, and to all the participants as well. I wish you all a good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.